I have a question about how higher education plays into this skill building the following way. You know, I imagine that some of the things that we learn in school, the value that, of what we learn versus our work experience, it depreciates over time.
Yeah.
And yet we hear that it's so valuable, this higher education, in the long term. Yet with you explaining that peak earnings has moved out from, you know, by 20 years, and we have this depreciation of higher education value over time, what's going on? How do those two concepts fit together?
That's a great question, Larry. So I think it's important, when you think about the value of higher education, to kind of break it into two parts. One is the specific things you learn how to do. So if you're an engineer or you're a computer scientist, you might learn, you know, specific programs, specific mathematical or computational processes, you know, things that are kind of in demand today. So, and those things do move fast and your skills do become obsolete, as you mentioned. So if you're a computer science major today, you're learning things that are completely different than what you learned 20 years ago. And that's less true in other majors. But there is a component of your value to the firm that is tied into the specific skills you know. But there's something deeper that's going on, which explains why actually the earnings advantage for college graduates actually grows over time rather than shrinks. And the reason is that it's not just the specific skills you learn that matter. It's also the kind of learning how to learn or learning how to think, critical thinking, problem solving, as I mentioned. You might want to think about what you do in college as actually practice for that kind of open-ended problem solving in the workplace. And that's the kind of skill that doesn't depreciate. So if you learn how to write analytically, if you learn how to carefully take apart texts, you learn how to work in a group on long-run projects where sometimes people don't do what they're supposed to do and people have different strengths and weaknesses, and how do you balance that? Those are the kinds of skills that are future-proof, that are they don't become obsolete, and you know, colleges could do those things better, but you do still do quite a bit of that kind of learning in college, and so I think that's actually responsible for the lion's share of the returns to college over time.
I want to talk about vocational learning.
Yep.
So, yes, some of the four-year colleges work on critical thinking and problem-solving skills, but there are others that work on very specific skills, like how to drive a truck, how to do plumbing, how to do welding, nursing schools. I recently invested in a business that does income sharing agreements where we pay for a kid's vocational education, and in return, if the young person earns more than a set amount, they share the earnings with us.
Yep.
And if they don't earn above some bogey, then their education is free. How do you think about vocational education as a means of either going back after you've done some work, before you've entered the workforce? Because it does seem like you also seem to want vocational learning. How should we think about new skill building?
Yeah, so I think, again, going back to these two types of skills, think about it as specific skills versus general skills or other ways to think about it. Vocational education, I think, is an important gap filler for people who, you know, if there's a need in a particular labor market and you want to move to a different type of career, and if you get Cisco certified as a software engineer, or if you learn how to be a welder, or if you learn how to be a radiology technician, there's a variety of vocational-like degrees and certificates that provide a nice earnings premium for a specific job. But they're not a global solution because they're kind of brittle in a sense, right? They only really apply to one type of job and often even a small set of employers in the area where you live. And so if those employers leave town, you don't have much of a way to get the benefit of those skills. Or if the technology of the job changes, then you also don't. So they're not always a long-run solution, which is why you see more efforts to try to get people to go back to school to kind of top off their skills. But if you look at what employers actually want, this Job Outlook survey I mentioned and other data clearly show that employers feel that they're very happy to have somebody else pay for training for their employees, but they think that the most critical weaknesses are actually in these, they sometimes say soft skills, I would call them general purpose or higher order skills like critical thinking and problem solving, et cetera. It's sort of like if you don't have that baseline, it's hard to move from job to job. And so if you're from the perspective of someone who wants to go get an education, you want to be getting skills that are valuable in lots of jobs, not just one. And so I would think of it as a both and rather than an either or.
I was reading one of your older papers, I think, that you wrote with Claudia, related to see what employers were looking for in resumes to decide whether or not to interview or hire people. Maybe you could comment a little bit about that, because you've mentioned some of these skills that they were looking for. But I think that, you know, it's also kind of a function of the economy. And let me give you an idea I was thinking about. One was is that if the economy is not doing very well, then you may want to reach out for someone who you think might be overqualified for the position, because you can get someone on the cheap. And they're not going to leave you when they, for a long time, so you can get some value. But like right now, the economy is running in the employment side so hot that I think employers might be reticent to look for people who have these sort of skills you're talking about, because for fear that they're going to get bid away very quickly. And we have to invest, as you said, in very firm, specific knowledge. How do you think about the decision about who to hire, who to invest firm-specific knowledge in, and the fear of getting that employee taken away?
Yeah, so I think it's really important, Larry, in this conversation to think about it from the perspective of each side of the labor market, right? And when you do that, I think you quickly see that there is a kind of mismatch inherent in the relationship between, you know, going to get skills and what employers want versus what workers want. So if you're somebody who's, you know, a young person going to get your education, you don't necessarily want to get – you're trying to get skilled up for a lifetime. So you're trying to go and spend a few years and acquire a set of skills that will make you employable for the rest of your working life. And those skills are often quite general. So that's what where the college degree comes in. On the other hand, if you're an employer, you have a perspective, I have a specific need I need to fill right now. In a hot economy, as you said, those needs get pretty urgent. And so you're willing to pay a lot for something right now to plug an immediate hole. And you actually don't really, you might even be willing to subsidize that skill. You might, you know, pay for your existing employees to get it because it's valuable to you. But you're never going to get employers to invest in general skills building. Why? Because if my employer pays for me, I shouldn't say never, but you're rarely going to get it. If my employer pays for me to go get a degree from a prestigious college, I can then leave that employer after a few years and take my skills somewhere else because the skill is useful everywhere, not just in this particular job. And so it's much easier to develop arrangements between the supply side and demand side of the labor market when the skills you're building are very specific to a particular firm or industry than it is to build skills that are useful in all types of jobs. So that's why you need an education system. That's why you need public support of higher education, of K-12 education, precisely because those skills are so general. You're not going to get a private market solution to that in any kind of global sense, I don't believe. Let me also just briefly mention, Larry, since you mentioned our audit study, Trip Down Memory Lane for me and Claudia. So that paper was actually, we created a bunch of fictitious resumes, and we sent them out to a bunch of employers, and we randomly changed the degree from which you, the school from which you got your degree. So some people had degrees from, bachelor's degrees from large online for-profit institutions, and some people had bachelor's degrees from less selective regional public institutions. And what we found was that the people who had degrees, these are not people, these are fake resumes who made up that are identical except for the degree, the resumes with the for-profit degrees got many fewer callbacks, suggesting that employers view that degree as a weaker signal of skills. So that was what we found in that study, and I'm happy to talk more about that, or maybe Claudia can pick up the torch in her section of the show.
There was a bunch of other interesting things about that I thought was interesting. One was you noticed that there was no discrimination on the basis of race in the callbacks.
Yeah.
I just wanted to understand how you tested for that and what you observed.
Yeah, so the way we tested for it is because we also randomly varied the race of the applicant and found no difference in callback rates. That's quite a real result from the perspective of our study. I have a hypothesis, we can't prove it, but as job applications become more online, you know, many of the resume studies, the famous one by Marianne Bertrand and Sindel Mullenithan, was pre-internet job postings. And I think what a lot of companies use now is resume screening software. So they automate the process of surfacing candidates for callbacks, which is kind of a virtue rather than a vice from our perspective, because if they're downweighting some colleges more than others, we actually want to know that, because that's kind of mechanically leading to differences in employment outcomes. But you could see why employers would be quite hesitant to do that on the basis of race, right? And so when you're using a screening technology, that might get rid of the racial difference in callbacks, but for example, it might not. It doesn't rule out discrimination on the basis of hires. You know, so you might still leave an applicant of color in the pool to call them back to protect yourself legally, but then not hire them or something. So I don't think you should conclude from our study that there's no discrimination in the labor market. I just think you can conclude that
in our study. Let me just say one thing to the audience. These resumes do not include race, but they have name, and we used names that were more black names or more white names or more Hispanic names.
That's correct. Yeah, thanks, Claudia. Yeah, so we signaled race with the names. And the way we did that, slightly different from some of the other studies, was we picked we basically calculated frequency of names and then uniqueness of names by race. And so we picked the most common, most frequently black or Hispanic names and used those.
All right. Different direction. This one relates to brains versus brawn. So you mentioned in your introductory remarks that the value of brawn has been in steep decline, first with agriculture and then with manufacturing. And now we're in this much more brain-intensive service economy. We got a question from Alan Herskowitz, who is one of our listeners, and he was wondering about how AI will affect these various human-machine interrelations.
Yeah.
And let me try to narrow the question in the following way. We've had discussions on our program where Charles Isbell, for example, from Georgia Tech, who runs the Dean of Computer Science over there, he mentioned that the way what the machines are powerful, the AI machines are powerful, humans are powerful, but together they're really powerful. And it comes down to how you can use this information or use these tools to make you better. And I'm thinking, like, as an example, in medicine, there's talks of new methods where doctors would be given information from the AI machine to suggest different conclusions that take advantage of all the research that's out there. How do you think about how this new skill of how you work interrelated with the machine to solve problems? So team building that with other people, but with machines.
Right. So I think it's a great question. I think it's important, if we want to dig in on this, to define exactly what we mean by AI. So there's this kind of two conversations around AI, loosely speaking. One of them is about the current state of AI, the uses of AI today by firms. You know, for example, the Netflix algorithm that decides what shows to recommend to you is an example of artificial intelligence, or how does Amazon know how to price the things you're buying as you scroll through the app, or what to offer you. That's artificial intelligence technology in its current state. And then there's this kind of nebulous conversation about AI, general intelligence, you know, computers taking over the world. I don't have a lot to say about that second conversation, but what I can say is how I think that this skill demand will be affected by the kinds of AI technologies that are already in existence and kind of the near future of it. So if you think about what those technologies are doing, they're actually assembling large amounts of data, which are just records of past experiences of, you know, customer transactions or web search behavior or whatever it is, and there are technologies that are fundamentally about making predictions. So they take massive amounts of data, much more than a human could computationally handle, and predict some outcome. So they might predict, well, given all the things that Larry's watched before, what does he want to watch today? And they're going to use lots of people that look like Larry, and they're, you know, viewing histories and kind of combine it and think about all the interactions between the variables in ways that are much more complex than what people can do to get a better prediction. But making predictions is only an input into decision making. It's not the decision itself, right? And so that prediction may be more or less accurate depending on what else is going on. And so what I think people are good at is figuring out, you know, how do you use predictions as inputs into decisions? How do you design the environment so that you're making the right choices or paying attention to the right things? Like, what am I even trying to predict? Why should I be trying to predict it? What do I care about? Whose welfare am I interested in? Those are all these kind of fuzzy meta-level things going on in human interaction and human decision-making that I think are far more complex than what any AI can currently handle. And so I see them as highly complementary, but that's my reasoning for it, which is largely in agreement with Professor Isbell.
I want to bring Claudia into the conversation. Claudia, you wrote this book, Education Technology, and you looked at over the history of, let's say, the 20th century. We made, as a society, choices, individuals made choices about how much to invest in education. And you noticed that the returns of education varied over various long-term cycles. Sometimes there'll be too many people with skills relative to the job opportunities, or not enough people with skills resulting in very large returns to education. Given what David has been saying about these new skills that managers and businesses are looking for, how should we expect people to change their decisions on how to invest in their own educations? And what are we seeing out there in terms of changes in choices of majors and going to school and for how many years based upon the skills that they have?
Sure. I think that going back to the history, it was rare in history for there to be too much education. There may be one small period in U.S. history in the 1970s, which led to the writing of a book by one of my colleagues, The Overeducated American. But in fact, not much after he wrote that book, he was wrong. And in fact, the returns to higher education zoomed up. And that was a brief period in which the end of the Vietnam War led there to be a huge group of individuals who were highly educated, in part because they were trying to escape from being drafted. So in fact, it's almost always the case that there's too little good education. And one of the reasons is that individuals cannot sell themselves. We do not have slavery. And so therefore, there's no collateral. And so education is an uncollateralized loan. You don't get a mortgage on it. And in fact, the loans that we do have are loans for which you cannot get out of. And that has a very interesting history. So if anything, we should be investing more in education. In fact, the cutbacks of the state system, of community college system, has led to too little education. The returns to the marginal year for the marginal student in higher education, which many very, very good empiricists have identified, is still extremely high. So that's the first point. Then you ask, well, given that people sort of should be investing in education, what type of education should it be? And clearly that, you know, when young people go to a college and see this enormous array, like, a, you know, chocolate of potential majors, it's very difficult. And there's more of an attempt to give information about, you take this major, you can probably earn this much in the future. But there's obviously a lot of uncertainty. But we can see that more and more young people are going into computer science, into biology. Many of the humanities are being left, although they're still extremely useful. Writing, writing is still a very, very important skill.
I mean, just following that up, what David is saying, when we're looking for general problem-solving skills and writing skills, you would think that this would result in more people wanting to major in the humanities, but we're seeing an exodus for specific skills like computer science, which David said had these highly depreciable educational benefits, and that, you know, what we really should be doing is building skills that we can use for a lifetime. How do you make sense of that?
But there are sort of general coding skills where universities, when they teach computer science, are not teaching people how to put square pegs into square spaces. They're teaching individuals to think about what type of pegs to create. So these are, you know, the really good programs are not vocational programs. This is not a sort of what one might call a pre-professional degree. This is a degree that is rooted in higher order mathematics.
Yeah, and just to say, Larry, I mean, I think there's a sense in which the answer is just you really want both. and what you see. So I've done some earlier work looking at the exactly what we've been talking about, which is depreciation of returns to high-tech majors, STEM majors. But that doesn't mean that it's bad to be a STEM major. It just means that you've got an initial earnings advantage of, let's say, 40% if you're a computer science major relative to being a history major. But then by the time you're, you know, 35, 40 years old, that advantage has gone down from 40% to 15%. But it's not like you're doing worse. What you see empirically is that at some point, if you think about, you know, you acquired the frontier knowledge in computer science when you go to college, but that frontier moves outward rapidly. And by the time you're 40 or 45 years old, you need to have enough knowledge to understand what's happening in the field, even if you're not actually doing the programming. Then you become a manager or somebody who makes decisions about what you should invest in. And that requires some technical knowledge, but it also requires these general purpose skills. And those are the people that really advance these days, are people who have both the technical skills and the general purpose, you know, complex higher order skills, problem solving, critical thinking, et cetera, teamwork.
You know, we had Zvi Galil, who runs Georgia Tech's new online computer science school. And I think he has something on the order of 12,000 students now in his program. It's the largest online program. And I'm just, it's what's really interesting about it is who's taking the classes. So it's much more domestic than Georgia Tech. It's much older than the typical Georgia Tech student. And what I think is really interesting is it's cheap, much cheaper than the Georgia Tech degree. I think it was like $8,000 or something a year. And it's a master's program in computer science. How do you think about online? You know, you were showing that employers were not very not excited about the for-profit schools. How do you feel about the online approach to allowing for mass production of these skills or these concepts that we're talking about?
Yeah, great question. So when I think about online degrees, I think about it again in two different parts. So one is think about it, roughly speaking, as the big lecture. So there's some things about education you can scale almost infinitely, right? So like, why would you listen to David Deming lecture Econ 101 when you could listen to Claudia Golden? She's much better. And if she produces a 45-minute lecture and I produce one, we can all watch it. The marginal cost of another person watching it is zero. And so the returns ought to go to the best lecturer, which is going to be Claudia rather than David. Right? So in the lecture component, which is just watching somebody else transmit knowledge, that scales to the online format. But that's not all that education is. Education is also meeting your learning needs where they are, identifying holes in your learning and addressing them, providing support around the learning experience. That's tutoring. That's checking your work and providing feedback. Those things really don't scale online at all, actually. I mean, you can do them online, but the online advantage, there's a benefit in terms of access. So there's some folks who couldn't physically be on the Georgia Tech campus who could go into this program, so that's a benefit to them. But it's not like an infinite cost scaling. And so when I look at the online education landscape, what I see is not much evidence that it can bend the cost curve at all on these important support components of education. I think it can on the lecture component, and so I think as online education matures, what we'll see is more separation of the functions, right? So like, it's not clear to me that an in-person 600-person lecture is any better than online, and so you'll think you'll see more of those things go online. But you know, here at Harvard and other institutions that are fortunate to have the resources Harvard does, a lot of what we do in education is actually supporting students in their personal learning journey, and that's very expensive, and is not particularly helpfully done online.
Yeah, Larry, the program that you described was evaluated by two economists, Josh Goodman and Amanda Pallas, and they found that it to have an enormously high return. This is the Georgia Tech program. But part of it, I think, is that there was a touch component. So that's what David was referring to, whether there's a high touch or sort of a no touch component to these online courses.
I think you're absolutely right. There is a touch, and they use students. They've hired a lot of TAs to help them, and then a lot of the former students have become TAs as well, as sort of a symbiotic relationship. All right, let's try a different path. David, given this, your findings, how would you change public policy to improve or to take advantage of this information?
Yeah, so I mean, for me, the primary implications would be in the education and training side. So how do we, if we think these, if you accept my argument and you think these are important skills, you know, are we doing as much as we should to build them intentionally in education and training institutions in the U.S. and around the world? And I think the answer to that is no. I think, you know, some people acquire those skills. As I mentioned, people do acquire those skills in college. That doesn't necessarily mean that college is the most efficient way of delivering them. It probably isn't. But the difficulty is that unlike, I don't know, you want to call them foundational skills like numeracy and literacy, you know, there's not like, okay, it's fourth period, we're going to teach teamwork now. These skills are kind of, they sit above specific content, and they're more about how you approach information, how you work together with people. And so it's not as simple as, you know, writing a textbook and transmitting knowledge to people. You sort of have to engineer the learning environment differently. And so I do think you see that happening in a lot of places. As far as I can tell, as a college professor myself, there's much more team orientation. There's many more group projects now than there used to be. Students don't like that always, but they need to do it because that's the way the workplace looks. But I think even the idea of grades is very individualistic. I mean, I don't have a good alternative solution, but I think a lot of what we do in education is kind of implicitly or even explicitly pushed towards individualism, when actually learning how to you know, make a team better is really important. And so I've done some work on how to do that, which I'd be happy to get into. But I think basically starting from first principles and saying, if we were to redesign the learning environment from scratch to build these skills, how would we do it? And then trying to get us closer to that, I think, is the right frontier to push on.
Just as I think about, I'm dated. So
we're all dated. We're all a little dated.
I took Claudia's class 37 years ago.
That means, you know, I gave it 37 years ago.
Exactly. That's the way the math works. And what I mean by that is that, you know, when I had my group projects at Penn, what happened was invariably, you know, in the group, one kid would do most of the work and the other kids wouldn't really do it. And there was a lot of anger and frustration with those students that kind of, you know, took advantage of the system. But in the work environment, you know, that probably wouldn't occur very much. There would be a problem, a disciplinary problem associated with that, and that guy would be kicked off the team. And going back to the Georgia Tech example about how that touch worked with it was other students and who became TAs and how they interacted with those people. And I could think of certain of the Montessori schools even, where, you know, third graders would teach second graders and ninth graders would teach seventh graders. And there were, you know, this idea of working together in a sort of symbiotic relationship like that. How are the universities dealing with and comparing this problem that I just gave?
Yeah, so I think right now what we've done is say, oh, well, you know, it's important to learn how to work with others, so we're going to take the same types of assignments and we're going to make them group projects instead, which is a kind of add-on to an existing structure rather than of any kind of fundamental rethink. But, you know, I mean, and I'm not going to pretend to have all the answers here, Larry, but I think one thing you might think about is, suppose we designed a course whose sole purpose was making you a better team player. How would we design that? Like, that's not something that's incidental. Like, we're teaching you calculus, but on the way we're teaching you how to do it in groups. No, we're actually teaching you how to be a better team member. What are the important components of being a good team member? Well, obviously there's effort, right? If somebody's, you know, shirking and not paying attention and not coming to meetings, that's bad. That's kind of basic. But then there's also what economists would call comparative advantage, right? So when Claudia and I write a paper together, we arrive at a division of labor. You know, in our case, since I'm a little closer to the data frontier, maybe I would do the data work and Claudia would do the writing because she comes up with wonderful titles like the title of our paper together, Nimble Critters or Agile Predators. And she would, you know, write the introduction because she knows the field better than I do and she can set the table well. But that's very different than the division of labor I would arrive at if I was writing a paper with one of my graduate students, where I might serve the function Claudia served and my student might serve the function that I served. And so do I have the wisdom to understand where I fit in on a team when everyone has different strengths and weaknesses? And some people have that naturally and some people don't, but what if we tried to teach that? What if we intentionally gave people feedback about how they divided their labor in a group and how they could do it better? You know, it's just not something we're doing in most colleges and universities because we're not intentionally building the skill of teamwork or the skill of decision making. Like, how do you use information to make better decisions? How do you give people feedback so that they understand, you know, how to make this decision better than the last one? It's all kind of in the air and incidental rather than being done purposively.
David, this is Claudia. What about athletics? Is that some reason why we have athletics in universities?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I don't know if it's the reason we have athletics. I mean, it may be one benefit of athletics is to build team skills, and I think you do hear from a lot of employers they like to hire athletes, although that's a mix of being a good in a team and, you know, having the self-discipline to keep yourself to a schedule. I mean, when I get up on Sunday mornings, I live on Harvard campus, when I get up on Sunday mornings, the only people I see out before 10 a.m. are the athletes. And so there's something to the work ethic of an athlete that matters too. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think again, like, there are elements of the college experience that build these skills, but we ought to lean into them and try to build them even better and build them for everyone, not just the people who happen to be in the right clubs or sports or what have you.
That reminds me, one of my work colleagues at Somm Brothers, Bruce Tuckman, once told me, no matter how many times I get promoted, I always end up working for a former football player. So there is something to that.